I'm going to tell you about what libraries have meant to me over my life. And when I was a child, we moved around a lot, and we moved in very small towns for the most part, so I didn't really have any library experiences until I was 6 years old. We lived in southern Texas. We lived on McNeil Island, which was a federal penitentiary because my dad was a guard. But obviously, they weren't places that were really big with public libraries or any libraries for little kids. When I was six, almost, we moved to Bonners Ferry, Idaho, a very small town on the boundary area. And while we were there, I was introduced to my first school library, which was a shelf of books in our classroom, and to a volunteer-run little library that was over the volunteer fire department in the downtown area. They were really, really good with lots and lots and lots of adult books, especially the classics. I think they probably had more copies of Moby Dick than most public libraries do today. But they didn't have very many children's books. It was important to my parents that we were familiar with books. So my parents bought us sets of books with stories in them. We had the golden books, so I knew the Pokey Little Puppy, and I knew the Color Kittens, and I knew the stories of Cinderella and the Brothers Grimm and the Andersen Tales. But they were from home, not from the public library, or even from our school library. When I was eight, we moved to the large town of Spokane, Washington, which even then was a large town for the Pacific Northwest. And that's where I first saw school libraries that had more than a shelf of books, where books were selected for the kids the appropriate age. And it was also where I saw my first branch library. The branch libraries, though, were rather particular. If you were a child, you read children's books. So if you were somebody that was a little advanced in your reading, you could read children's books, or your parents would check the books out for you. By the time I was in seventh grade, my parents were checking out Ivanhoe and the real Uncle Tom's Cabin, not the illustrated children's version, and Pilgrim's Progress, all things that I'd heard about. And when I would go to read them, the library would give me a children's version, and I would go, I can't imagine that this is the book that they were talking about in Little Women, or the book that President Lincoln said, so you're the little lady that wrote the book that started the big war for Uncle Tom's Cabin. But luckily, my parents made sure I got to read the books I wanted to read. Our school library, when I was in Spokane, was also a very good library. That's where I met and began to read authors like C.S. Lewis's Narnia series and the Kate Serity books, and discovered that there were lots and lots of different kinds of books to read, besides The Black Stallion, which I loved dearly, and The Island Stallion. My father got transferred once again, and so in my freshman year in high school, we lived in Port Huron, Michigan. We lived in what's called the Thumb area, which is 60 miles north of Detroit. Michigan is shaped like a mitten for the lower part. We lived on the mitten. The town was a medium-sized town, but they had an old Carnegie Library, and my brother Tim discovered it before the rest of us did. We all got library cards. Every time we had summer vacation, we'd all head for the library. I'm the oldest of nine children. We'd all check out as many books as possible, including my mother and dad. We packed the books up with us. We took them camping with us. When it was too rainy to be out, we would read our books and our brothers and sisters' books and our mom and dad's books. And then we'd come home and bring them back to the library. When I was a senior in high school, we got a phone call. The public library had this policy where they always had a page, somebody to shelve books, from every one of the high schools in the town. And the person who'd been doing it from the high school I went to was graduating. I'd been recommended by the teacher as a possible person to work. The library was in transition. It had been a small city library. It was becoming part of a county system. And they were going to build a new library to be the county headquarters, and all of the books in the city library were going to move to the county library. So they were also losing some of their staff. I started as the page in the children's room right after the children's librarian resigned. So as a page in the children's library, people introduced me to things, but I got to finish up the summer reading program. They let me tell story hours. They needed somebody to file cards in the children's card catalog. They let me do that. They showed me how to do some reference things. I was still a senior in high school. When they became a real library, the St. Clair County Library, I became more like a clerk than a page. And I got to do more different kinds of things and really became quite interested in what this library work was about. I got to work on bookmobiles. And I got to talk to people who were in the field and were thinking about the field. And we talked about 4-year degrees and 5-year degrees. One of the best advice I ever got about going to college and getting a library degree was, go for 5 years, because if you go for 5 years, you start out with 4 weeks vacation. And I said, I like school. I can go for 5 years. I would like always having 4 weeks vacation rather than starting out with 2 weeks and maybe working my way up to four. So when I graduated from high school, that's what I did. I went to library school. But I have to confess, I didn't go to the best school in Michigan, which in those days for library science was really the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. But I went to Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo because I was homesick for the West, and it was called Western, and they had hills. And I didn't want to live in a city. And Ann Arbor, even their university looked like a city with high rises and flat land. And Kalamazoo just appealed to me. So I went there, got my library degree. And when I was up for my master's, I had an opportunity to have 2 different fellowships. One of the fellowships would let me go any place I wanted afterwards. And the other said, you had to promise to work in the state of Michigan for 2 years. So obviously I took the one that would let me go any place I wanted to afterwards, which was really a good idea, because before I finished my graduate year, my mother and father got transferred back to Seattle with my younger brothers and sisters. So there I was, finishing my schooling. And when I got out, I packed up myself and my dog, whom I smuggled onto the plane, because they kept saying, if we don't like what you put your dog in, we will take her off in Chicago. Well, I wasn't going to have that. And this was the days before they x-rayed your bags or checked your bags. And so I carried her on in a little duffel bag. And the two of us landed in the Seattle airport. And I began to look for a job in Seattle, just as all those signs were going up around Seattle about the last person to leave, turn out the lights. Boeing had one of their downturns. Nobody was hiring in public libraries or any library in the Seattle area. My mother and father's family both lived down here in the Portland-Vancouver area. And my dad's mom was going to have eye operations. So I came down here and stayed with her for a while and stayed with my mom's family. And I decided to apply at the Library Association of Portland, which was the name of this library in those days. And I went to the library. Well, first of all, I phoned up and said, I'm interested in being a librarian. I have my master's degree. What do you need? And they said, well, bring this material here. And I set up an appointment. I showed up on the third floor at the Central Library. And the woman who was staffing the desk in the HR department was new. And she looked at me and she could tell I was young. So she thought I was coming to be a clerk. And she said, well, we'll start you off with a typing test. And I thought, well, that's very strange, but all right. So I started the typing test. She came in and said, oh, I hadn't realized you're applying as a librarian. You don't have to take a typing test. The HR person came in and we started to talk. We talked about where I'd lived, what my interests were, where I'd been, what I was hoping to do. And I'd had so much experience as a children's librarian, even though I'd never been one, that I'd really focused on children's work when I'd been in library school. To be exact, one of my practical experiences had been working with the Kalamazoo Public Library with Sesame Street when it first became available. They put color TVs in their public libraries in the disadvantaged areas so that parents would bring their young children in and somebody in the library staff would work with young children working with Sesame Street to improve their reading skills. So I'd had that experience. Well, needless to say, there was no children's positions available in the library at that time. But they had somebody who was working with young adults who was pregnant and was going to go on leave. So they did some checking and they called me and they said, would you like to start work at the end of October? And I said, well, yes, I would. And I had 4 weeks vacation. And I'd always thought that if I started out at $6,000, which was a very nice salary in those days, I'd be very happy. And they let me start out at $7,100 a year. I was on easy street. I was delighted. I worked in Popular Library. That's where the young adult collection was. We had a small amount of nonfiction. We had a small amount of young adult fiction. I worked a lot with the adult collection in the fiction department. We had a collection of magazines that were popular, but only the most recent edition. Anybody who wanted old ones had to go up to the periodical room, which was on the third floor. And I discovered the Central Library, and it was a marvelous place to work. I was very lucky that the woman I worked with in Popular Library had worked for the library from before World War II and during the war years. So she would tell me stories about the library during those transition periods. And she would tell me stories from before her time here. So I heard that the reason we let people bring their dogs into all of the libraries in Multnomah County was because Miss Isom, who was the librarian who worked to get this building built in 1913, had a dog, and her dog came to work with her. And because her dog came to work with her, anybody who wanted to come use the library could bring their dog with them. So when I started working here, people brought their dogs into the library. They also sometimes brought in their cats and other pets. And as long as they were well-behaved, nobody minded. I heard about how between the third floor and the second floor, because this was an old building, and gas lights and electric lights were not very good, there was an opening from the skylight that's on the third floor that put natural light down onto the second floor. And that opening was protected by a railing. But then as time went by and people became somewhat less respectful, and sometimes kids would fool around, and people would drop things on people working on the second floor. They put a little canvas around the edges of it to catch things like gum papers and things. However, one day the staff on the second floor looked up to see small children clambering over the railings to get onto the canvas. At that point, the decision was made to fill in that light well, and it was filled in. It has been since. For years, though, we were always told that whenever we did anything on the third floor, we had to make sure directly under the skylight that we never put anything really heavy there because they weren't sure what kind of a load level it had. When the building was remodeled in the 1990s, of course, all of the load level on the third floor is the same, so we don't have that concerns anymore. But that used to be a major concern. You would never put any heavy cabinets or bookshelves or anything in that middle area in the early days. Wow. So when I first started to work here, the library had been plugging along, doing pretty good. The county provided our money, but basically the Library Association of Portland took the money and invested it and used some of the money to buy land and build branches, and sometimes people would donate things. And the Central Library belonged to Multnomah County, but the ownership of all of the branches and the books, well, the Library Association of Portland figured pretty much that they were contracted by the county, and so the county gave them the money, and everything they bought belonged to them. And legally, if you looked at the paperwork, they were probably right. However, the county had a lot of stuff invested in it. And for years, they tried to do all the work they were supposed to be doing, as well as making sure that the library had a certain amount of money. During the Vietnam War years, when inflation was so high, however, tax revenues did not rise nearly as fast as inflation did. And in 1972, the county found themselves in a lot of trouble. And basically, they came to the Library Association of Portland and said, "This is the amount of money we can afford to give you." And the Library Association of Portland said, "Well, we can only keep the Central Library and 6 branches open. And we won't have any way to even move the books out of the other buildings we have. We'll just have to board them up." And the Multnomah County said, "We just don't have any more money." And the people in the city became very concerned, and they began to form the Friends of the Library. That's when they started. And to look at ways to do fundraising and to find alternatives. And the county began to look at, you know, well, what was this decision the library board was making? And the library board was saying to the county, "Well, this is what you're going to give us. This is what we're going to do." And the people in the county and the members of the library, the county board, were saying, "But this is our money. Don't we have any input in this?" And that really began a time of a lot of conflict between what kind of money we were getting and who was giving it. Now, you may all go, "But I don't remember hearing that all the branches were closed up. And I don't remember branches reopening. And I don't, what was going on?" Federal revenue sharing came in that year. And when federal revenue sharing came in, the county immediately provided us with the gap in funding. But they also told the board that they didn't know what they would do when federal revenue sharing money ran out. So from that time until basically the time we became part of the county in 1990, there was a real sense of who runs the library, how much responsibility, and how much input could the county have, since they basically were the funder, and how much of the special collections that the Library Association of Portland had gotten over the years. Some of them were purchased, some were donations by members of the Library Association of Portland, which was a private association. And that kind of conflict went on in the middle 80s. The Library Association of Portland had a vacancy for the librarian. And they went out and they interviewed people and they hired a man. And people said, "Wait a minute, isn't this a field with a lot of women? Did they even look at any women?" And the county commissioner said, "Show us what you did to find the person you hired." They had to redo their whole process. And the second time around, they hired a woman. Wasn't necessarily a good process. And before the woman's tenure was over, we'd had our library strike. Because the other thing that had happened is the library staff was also going, well, you know, don't we have any input into what this library is doing? And so they had created a private association that was basically recognized as a union. They went through an NLRB vote and became the library union. And we were to negotiate contracts, and negotiations fell apart, and the staff who were in the bargaining unit walked out. We had a 3-day strike. We walked back in, but we had story hours. People in the county were irate that this library staff were being treated this way. And basically, we got some things we wanted, but that also created a higher profile. And then, again, with different property tax limitations that were coming in, again, the county was running into problems with how do they fund the library? How is the funding handled for a private nonprofit if your funding is being capped as a property group? And so, basically, by 1990, the Library Association of Portland and the county got into serious negotiations about who was going to handle it. They had an interim library director, Charlie Davis, who was locally known for his activism in the Citizens Board for the Cub. Mm-hmm. And he was very involved in that. Didn't have a lot of experience with libraries, but he knew how public entities ought to work. And he worked with the negotiations, setting up how the library would, as it would negotiate with the county, and how the county would negotiate with the Library Association of Portland, working up with the various groups who were concerned about things like the Rembrandt etchings that the Library Association of Portland owned, and the Audubon folios, which we still have here in our rare book room. And all of those things happened over that year with Charlie Davis. He also worked at setting up the process with the county for hiring who was going to be the librarian that was going to replace him, which is when Jenny Cooper came. And all of that transition of the Library Association of Portland as the owners and the runners of the library to us becoming a county library and county employees, the employees moving from being a private association to part of AFSCME, a major union, the changes in looking at us as a county department, and then the changes as we became our library district, which was a change. And that had been something we tried to do once before in the early 80s. But in those days, because of the way we were set up and because we didn't necessarily have the kind of support that we needed to do it with the charter, we had to get the okay from the city of Portland and all the other taxing entities in Multnomah County. And the city of Portland just simply said, why would we want to do that? And so that was the end of that. So going into the county helped us get the kind of credibility with the people in Multnomah County that we needed, and helped us develop into a really working part of county government and the city of Portland. And I think we're seen as a partner with a lot of different groups instead of this specialized little group that sometimes people liked and sometimes people were really, really upset that they had no input to. The people in the Library Association of Portland did a lot of good things for a very long time. But everything sort of has their lifetime. And I think what happened is that's what happened with that group. And they were able, in many ways, to see that. And many of their members, or the families of their members, still work with the Library Foundation or their friends. And so that's also good, too. We haven't cut our ties with those people. And they haven't cut their ties with us. So that's all I have to say, I think.
It's fantastic. It sounds like you have a really extensive history of using and working for the library here in the area.
Yes. I didn't mention that we became computerized. We were one of the earliest libraries to do that. And that was not always a good experience. When we first became computerized, there was a time period where basically they couldn't check in or check out. They could check out books, but they couldn't get them checked in. And so they were just basically, in order to have books on the shelves, had to check them in. And then when they went to check them out, if they found out they were still checked out, clear the record and check them out to the new person. That was a very long time ago, and people were just learning how to do checkout systems. So, but that was very hard. And we were a very large library doing it very early on. And everybody was learning, including the people who were doing circulation systems in those days. So,
I can imagine it would be a fun process to be a part of.
Very different.
Yeah. Well, how would you sort of describe the library now in its current state based on what you just told us?
I think that we have a lot of new people and a lot of young people. There are very few of us who have worked as long as I have. There are a lot of people who were hired in the 80s and 90s, but there are an awful lot of people that we've hired recently, and they've worked in a lot of different branches. They're very familiar with a lot of the online resources, and they're very, very, very interested in public service. The public service aspect, I think, is really important with almost anybody who works in a public library. People do come in and they say, oh, I can't believe there was so-and-so, and I thought that person looked strange, or that was, oh, I heard somebody yelling or using a four-letter word. That's been true of every public library I've worked in, whether it was that mid-sized library in Port Huron, Michigan, or when I first started here. We had people who used drugs who came into Popular Library in 1970 who would sort of look sort of like they were going to pass out. We had people in those days before the Hooper detox who would come in, and in the wintertime, there were certain people that I knew and everybody on staff knew that during the summertime they came in and they'd be a little weird, you know, drunk. But in the wintertime, they'd come in drunk. And they would come in drunk because they wanted us to call the police to arrest them so that they would have a warm place to spend the night. And the Hooper Detox Center is named after a man whom I met when about 1971, I believe. And he would come in. He'd come in drunk. I went to call the police. These lovely ladies didn't want this poor drunk old man to be arrested, so they hustled him out of the building. And when he came back in later that night, he was almost irrational. People couldn't understand it because, I mean, he was a nice drunk. I mean, he wasn't a problem. And so when the police came, they took him to jail, and he died in jail overnight. And the thing is, he was a really nice man, and he had a lot of influential friends. He'd graduated from the U of O. People gave him money. They didn't know him. He just was an alcoholic, pure and simple. Later on, I heard a story from the person who at that time was the library director, and we were all aware when he died because we were just shocked. I mean, for years he'd come in, he'd gone to jail, he'd slept it off. He came out the next day, and everybody wondered what had happened. When Miss Phillips at that time, she was leaving work and she saw him staggering around. And she thought, oh, he must be going to the library to get arrested. And suddenly he fell and he hit his head on a glass door that was locked. She started towards him to help him up, and he got up and seemed to be walking as normal. And she thought, oh, well, I mean, people always thought that, you know, drunks didn't hurt themselves when they fell. And apparently he probably had hurt himself and hurt himself badly. So that's probably why when he came back to the library, he was more out of control than he had ever been before. And it's very possible that he died because he had a concussion, but nobody knew that. And there wasn't anybody watching it, because that's what the drunk tag was. You put him in there to sleep it off. But that's basically what started the Hooper detox and Central City Concern. Is this man's friends were so upset that he had died in jail that they tried to find alternatives. And to see how the city of Portland and the people in Portland reacted to it, trying to make changes, and to also look at the difference in how we handled it. I mean, nowadays, we have our FSOs who are paying attention to, you know, is this person who is in the library and obviously is under the influence, how do we make sure that we're not just putting them out on the street? You know, we call Central City Concern, that is to say they do, or they call the Portland police if that's appropriate. But they try to make sure that nobody's out there where they're going to walk into traffic and get hurt, or whether they're going to be passed out, or where somebody can roll them or treat them badly. So it's a difference in our attitude to people. But I will say, members of the public who don't see that part of what has always been part of what the public library does, that is, we try to provide information and material and a place where everybody can come and find something they need. They may not find everything they need. We may not be able to provide them with everything they need. But we don't want it to be a place where somebody comes and we don't have anything they need. We want to be able to help people have recreation, learn things, do things they want to do that they can't afford to do. We want to work with everybody. We want to work with children and babies and adults and crazy people and super uptight people and people who are just too laid back to believe. We want to work with the public, and we want the public to feel comfortable coming in here, no matter what their education level is, or how much they know about a certain thing, or how little they know. Because, heck's sakes, a lot of times we don't know very much about any one thing. What we know here, and I think this is true of all of our new people, is we know how to start to find something that will hopefully help somebody who knows something find more. And that's what we're here about, is to help people find more of what they're looking for.
That's great. No, it sounds like you've, you know, affected a lot of lives out there, I'm sure, and changed a lot of people in your role as a librarian and working for the library.
And I mean, I see the new people who we have still doing that, you know, sitting there listening to people and making suggestions or what they can read or new ways of doing things, new ways of reader's advisory and helping people do research and introducing them to new databases or just listening to, so you want to develop a new business or so you're trying to find out what happened to your grandfather that just sort of, he just disappeared. So where we do genealogy, we do things in the branches. I would say one of the things that's really big is the databases we have, because at one time, the branches were always having to refer things to the central library. And now there's a lot of things they can do to start out. We still have many specialized collections. There still often comes a point of time when somebody in the neighborhood library will say, well, let's refer you to somebody at Central who might know more, they might know about a particular book or a particular collection. But a lot of times with our genealogy databases or our historic Oregonian online or with the business databases that we have, we can get people started a lot more than we used to be able to, where the only things that were available were the print things that were very expensive and that you had to buy every year, and that the branches didn't have space to have them, or if they had the business directories, then they didn't have the bestsellers, and they didn't have the encyclopedias and the other things they needed. So now sometimes online they can get lots and lots of things with no space taken up on their bookshelves and have material for people to come in and check out new books and find Lucky Day collections, which were things that were not even part of our imagination. So that was one of the things that was just, is really nice about living about today. I've had people say to me, aren't you tired of having the same job for 44 years? When I first started learning about this job, there weren't any computers. And when my library at Western Michigan University got a hardwired connection to the catalog at Ann Arbor, that wasn't what was checked in or checked out, but just the fact that I could look at their catalog and say, oh, they own this book. That was a big technology advance. And nowadays, nobody would think anything of that. They say, well, who cares? Is it checked in? Is it checked out? Can I have it? So that kind of thing is very exciting. The amount of access that people have and the fact that we as a library can be a way that they can have access to our collection, that's really great. And the other libraries' collections. So we seem to be a lot more connected in a lot of ways. And I think we can serve people a lot more. And I think people are looking for us to serve them in more and new ways. And sometimes that's scary. And sometimes that's really expensive. But sometimes it's just a matter of us catching up with technology or technology catching up with us. And sometimes it's just the old thing of handing somebody the book that they're looking for, whether that book is on their Kindle, or on their computer, or on their telephone, or in good old paper, so when you go to read it in your bed and you fall asleep and it falls on your chest, it just falls on the floor and you don't have to replace it.
Well said. So. I think just sort of going off that too, are you excited for the future of libraries and how their role will play?
Oh, yes. To be exact, I joke with Jim Carman that once I retire, one of the things I really like, because I do genealogy, is I like reading old-style handwriting. And Jim has these collections of old paper files, and I'm really good at reading that stuff. So I keep telling him, well, if he still needs somebody when I retire, I'll go help read that stuff so when they digitize it, they'll know that they... the optical scanners are reading it right. Or if the optical scanners can't read it, at least I can read it and people will know what it says. So, and that's an exciting thing, that optical scanners can do that kind of thing now. And people can see the actual documents as well as search for stuff that's in them. That's really neat. So there's lots of potential and lots of exciting things. So yeah, I'm excited about it. I can't imagine never, ever not doing something with libraries personally, as well probably in volunteer, reading to my nephews and nieces and grandnephews and nieces and my great-grandnephews and nieces, which I now have. And further on, because I'm from a big family, Lord knows I can have lots of those. And who knows what kind of volunteer things there'll be out there with the advances of technology. Maybe sometime I can stay at home and do library material and help somebody at a library using databases at another library. So that would be fun. Don't know. But there's a lot of potential.
It sounds like it. And, you know, we're running a little short on time now, but we'd just like to thank you again for coming in and sharing your stories with us. And it was great hearing everything you have to share.
Well, you're very welcome. And I'm glad you're here at Multnomah County Library, because this is a really lovely, historic library.
It sounds like it. And thanks again, Janet.
You're welcome.